tonight on Arena. Violinist Henning Craggerud is live in studio with music from Vivaldi's Four Seasons and Nuala O'Connor and Stephen James Smith celebrating writing about Dublin. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch the whole thing on rte.ie/arena. Known for his engaging performances of Norwegian music, orchestrations of Bach's Goldberg Variations, Norwegian violinist Henning Craggerud is teaming up once again with the Irish Chamber Orchestra for the third time, in fact. This time it's a series of concerts in Limerick, Dublin and Mayo, and Craggerud and the Irish Chamber Orchestra will explore Vivaldi's masterpiece, bringing each season to life with dramatic flair and interspersed between the Four Seasons. Craggerud will perform three of his own compositions, adding fresh perspectives to the music. I'm delighted that that we have Henning joining us from our Limerick studio this evening. And welcome to you once again. Good to have you back on Arena. It's a few years since we spoke, I think, at this point, Henning. It was when you were here doing your Norwegian music. I think that was when we last spoke, wasn't it?
Yes, I believe it was. And thanks for inviting me back again here.
Yeah, you're more than happy to have you here. What is it? The easy questions first. What is it about Vivaldi's Four Seasons? I mean, this piece has been around for hundreds of years, let's face it. The Four Seasons themselves have been around a little bit longer.
Yes.
What did Vivaldi do?
First of all, it's a little bit of an anniversary because it's exactly 300 years since the music was first published. Wow. In 1725. And along with the music, Vivaldi published four sonnets describing the Four Seasons. So it's very programmatic music. So when he mentions anything in these sonnets, you can hear all of it in the music.
Yeah.
So you can hear shepherds and nymphs dancing. You can hear birds singing. You can hear devastating storms. You can also hear the icy coldness of the winter. And at Vivaldi's time, which was during the Little Ice Age, Europe was much colder. Mm. So the temperature in Italy was more like it is in Norway today, and the channels of Venice would indeed freeze, so you could walk over them. So I've used nature as I know it from Norway. Wow. To inspire me interpretation.
In fact, I was looking today at a link that was sent to me of you on YouTube. With, of course, you would call the orchestra that you're involved with the Arctic Chamber Orchestra. Am I getting the correct title?
Arctic Philharmonic Chamber Orchestra in Tromsø. Yes.
Yeah, I beg your pardon. Arctic Philharmonic Chamber Orchestra. And I have to say, it was absolutely stunning performance. Now, I think what I have here is actually maybe a recorded version, but what I was looking at on YouTube was certainly had the feeling of live of it. But let's just hear how Winter opens. And at the beginning of the video, it simply says something like, "There's not much light around Norway at this time of the year." I think it was 9:30 in the morning, on the 23rd of November, if I have my date right.
Very good. Yes.
That you did this piece with the Arctic Philharmonic Chamber Orchestra. And you were standing outside for a lot of it. So maybe you didn't have to shake your tremolo with the bow. Maybe you just shook your hands because you were freezing cold. Let's have a listen.
Thank you.
There we have it, the opening of winter, the first movement from that Vivaldi piece from the Four Seasons. Henning Kraggerud was the soloist there playing alongside. I'm calling it your own orchestra, but I think you are the artistic director, if I'm right. I think it is your own orchestra, isn't it? The Arctic Philharmonic Chamber Orchestra, Henning.
Yes, I am artistic director there. But now, of course, I have a new capacity as well here in Ireland. So that's I feel very honored to now be artistic partner of the Irish Chamber Orchestra. That's a great honor for me. And we have started to plan also some collaborations between the orchestra, between the Arctic Philharmonic and Irish Chamber Orchestra. So hopefully I can tell you more about that in the future.
Well, of course, you know that if you're going to do a Four Seasons piece for Ireland, you'll have to do all 12 movements in one big piece, because Ireland has four seasons in one day, which I'm sure you have come to learn over your visits here.
Yes.
But I was really interested listening to that section of winter,
Yes.
One of the things that you get, you know, that you do really get that sense of iciness and that, you know, the dragging across the things, the yak, 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 yak in the beginning of the piece.
Yes.
But then Vivaldi just doesn't let us have some simple programmatic, just sonic description of winter. He then asks a huge amount of the soloist in the little virtuosic flourishes that come between those strings. How do you get your mind into a winter frame, if you like? Easy for somebody from Norway, I would have thought. But into a winter frame of thinking when you have to play such virtuosic music as well as something that simply sonically describes that season.
Well, I mean, this is the exciting thing about live concerts, that it is without any safety net. And I just love the thrill of being there in the hall and playing with the orchestra, like now with the Irish Chamber Orchestra. Mm. Where we have not only the possibility of one interpretation, but we have the possibility also of the inspiration of the moment. Now we are going to play three concerts in different cities in Ireland. Mm. But as I know the orchestra from before, those three concerts will not be the same.
Yeah.
We will play it. We will have so much fun on stage during the concerts, playing for the audiences. So I look so much forward to this tour.
And one of the things that you're doing in between the four, each concerto has three movements, so we've 12 movements in total. But after you finish Spring, for example, you then launch into one of your own compositions, Victime Paschali.
Yes.
My rudimentary Latin tells me that has something to do with Easter.
Yes. And actually, when Vivaldi was composing this, the Four Seasons, that year, it was also an unusually late Easter. And so we are soon approaching Easter. Mm. So after Spring, I thought it was good to include this. Vivaldi was also trained as a priest, though I believe he only had two sermons in his life. He was more interested into the music.
Yeah.
But I like to bring this aspect, and I will also tell the audiences a little bit about Vivaldi's life and also about how the poems and the sonnets relates to the music. So this is music written a little bit more than 300 years ago, but it's still as fresh as if it was newly written. So it has a wonderful score. You can make so many different types of interpretations. And also now I've asked the Irish Chamber Orchestra during rehearsals to sort of bring on their own views. So this will be absolutely a little bit different from I've ever done it before.
So, if, for example, when you're playing Victime Paschali in between Spring and Summer, that's a piece that you have composed previously. But will you, if you like, seep out of Spring and take little bits of Vivaldi to make your way into your own composition? Will it be totally improvised, or how will that work?
No, I think the transitions, I like to talk a little bit about the pieces to the audiences right before I play. So I will talk a little bit before each seasons and also before my own compositions. So I will then sort of mention a little bit about the Victime Paschali text and how this sort of the sufferings of Christ in the Easter and the hope and the doubt and everything also was part of Vivaldi's life. So hopefully this connection will put Vivaldi's music into a new relief or a new angle. So when we then move on after my composition to the summer, it will be affected a little bit by that.
Yeah, what we've just heard is, so it will link spring and summer in that fashion, which is kind of what Easter does, if you think about it in some ways. Easter, the moment in the calendar, does that as well. I am very impressed, not only by you, Henning, but by your daughter. Who,
thank you.
I was sent a wonderful YouTube link of this. Of the two of you playing Vivaldi's Four Seasons in 4 minutes, and you know, when you listen to it, you hear all the familiar themes, you see all, and you hear all the tunes that we know and love from the 12 movements of the four Vivaldi concertos. But I particularly like this little section, which is towards the end of the video of yourself and your daughter. What is her name, by the way?
Alma.
Alma. Yourself and your daughter. And I was very impressed by your dancing during this bit. Yeah, people have to imagine your daughter standing still looking at you with the "Dad, please stop" look on her face as you dance around her to this piece of music. And off you go into another little section.
We had so much fun. We made this arrangement together. We wanted to fit in all the Four Seasons actually in 3 minutes. And this video has done it on various platforms. It has been now seen, I think, about 1 million times. So it has been doing very well.
I am not surprised. It has to be said, like daughter, like father, like daughter. She clearly can play the violin. You're playing the viola, actually, I think.
I'm playing the viola. Yeah. But we make these kind of small arrangements of things just for fun for ourselves. And we like to make these small YouTube videos.
Small but very, very talented YouTube videos. But what struck me most was there is such a sense of fun in what you do. How important is that? Because particularly with classical music, Henning, I think there's often this idea, it's classical music, we all have to sit here, for heaven's sake, don't clap between the movements or you'll be thought of as a fool. And that we feel this kind of stricture to behave in a certain way. But Vivaldi's music in particular has such a sense of fun in it, in its description of the seasons.
Absolutely. And this is, one of the things I love with playing with Irish Chamber Orchestra is that they are willing to do all sorts of things, both in concerts and in rehearsals. So we have indeed the repertoire. We have been singing it. We have been dancing it. We have having like kindergarten type of games where we are sort of dramatizing the music also. So during rehearsal, it is very far from what most people maybe will think of as classical music. And this is, we have so much fun. I hope those persons who listen to this radio show, if you are able to come to one of the three concerts, please come. We just love to perform.
Yeah, Alma Serafina, in fact, is your daughter. I love the Serafina part of her name in there as well. Your daughter that we heard playing there. But music, I think, has always been important in the household. You might play, there's one particular piece of, you have the violin with you.
Yes,
you?
I do.
You do, very good. Tell us a little bit about that violin, by the way. Fairly special instrument.
Yes, it is. It's an instrument from 1744. It's a Guarneri del Gesù. And it is such a fantastic instrument, built of one of the best makers ever to have lived in Cremona. And it has also a special story because it used to belong to a violinist called Edith Laurent, who was a Jewish Hungarian violinist who had an orchestra in Germany between the two wars. And she narrowly escaped from the Nazi regime, and she then fled, eventually ending up in the United States. And this violin ended up in a collection, a kind of museum, and had a kind of Sleeping Beauty rest away from the concert stages. And when I got it around 2006, I got to wake this up, and now I've had it close to 20 years, and I still find new things in this instrument.
Clearly it carries such a potent history within it, within its body and within its sonority. I'm guessing that all of what you've described there is present in the notes that you play. But I'm thinking of, because the Norwegian thing I can't let go, obviously, but there's such a vast variety of Norwegian folk music. I mean, we often think of Grieg and the way he brought Norwegian folk music into classical music. What you have a piece that I think is very important to your family, and one that is very important to you as a result.
Yes, what do you think about now, just so I'm not sure exactly what you meant now.
Now I had, excuse my Norwegian.
The Margit Juxa.
Margit Juxa. Yes, that's the very one. Yes.
Do you want me to play that melody?
I would love to hear that melody.
Yeah, because this is something I sung for all the children even before they were born, and then they learned to play it, and it's a medieval ballad which is sung in Norway still. And I can certainly play this on the violin. I just need to take my headset off.
You need to take your headphones off. Well, I'll explain to people that you're making your way over to that particular microphone. Yes. I don't know if you can still hear me or not.
I can hear you now, but I can take it off now. So from now, I will not hear you.
Yeah, okay. Well, I will then allow you to go into Margit Juxa, which was the piece that you used to sing to your children. But now you're going to play it for our listeners here on Arena on the violin. Absolutely beautiful. Margit Juxa, Norwegian medieval ballad, which holds a special place in the heart of Henning Kraggerud, playing it live for us in our Limerick studio this evening ahead of his concerts with the Irish Chamber Orchestra. Have you got the headphones back on?
Yes, I have.
I do have to ask you one further question, which is very important. Now, students of the theory of music will know that a 16th note is a semi-quaver, an eighth note is a quaver. So a 32nd note would be a demi-semi-quaver. When you play demi-semi-quavers in Ireland, do they have a special meaning? Because I am fascinated to hear that you are 1/32nd.
Yes,
Irish.
This is true. I never thought of it in that way. But after we started the talks and I got this fantastic opportunity here in Ireland, I talked with my uncle who is into the family trees. And I said, I've heard rumors that I maybe have some Irish family. And he managed to dig out this information. And my, I don't know the correct way of saying that, a great-great-great-grandmother.
Yeah, that's That sounds good.
Yes, this was a lady called Sarah Strahan, born in 1816. And then that part of my family, she moved to England. So I have family, my great-grandfather was from the Manchester area. And also, and this is quite special, that he then moved to Norway after the First War, the Great War, and put up a pharmacy company, but actually in secret he put up the Scandinavian MI6 office in Scandinavia. So I come from a family of sort of agents, and and that would never have happened without the Irish contribution either. So it's a quite exciting family story. Though when I play with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, I feel much more than a 32nd Irish.
So it's not just the demi-semi quavers that get a special treatment.
No.
It's all the notes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Henning, listen, lovely to have spoken with you again this evening. And I'm sure we will talk more as your period as the new artistic partner with the Irish Chamber Orchestra.
I certainly hope so, yes.
It begins in August, and I'm sure there will be exciting projects about that. Thanks so much for joining us from our Limerick studio and for playing live for us this evening, Henning.
Thanks for inviting me.
That's violinist Henning Craigerud in our Limerick studio this evening. Vivaldi's Four Seasons with Henning and the Irish Chamber Orchestra is at the White Recital Hall. It's at the White Recital Hall in the Royal Irish Academy. On Friday. It's in Limerick tomorrow night, and it's in St. Patrick's Church in Newport, County Mayo on Saturday the 12th of April. And obviously we will be hearing a lot more from Henning as that Irish Chamber Orchestra artistic partnership gets into play next August. Dublin, Written in Our Hearts, the One Dublin, One Book Choice for 2025, is an anthology celebrating the city and its people, featuring some of the best writing from the past 20 years by Dubliners about Dublin and by other people, I would suggest, possibly as well. Now in its 20th year, the One Dublin, One Book initiative encourages everyone across the city to read a single Dublin-connected book throughout the month of April, and I'm delighted to be joined this evening by two of the contributors to Dublin Written in Our Hearts, Stephen James Smith, with me here in studio, and joining us on the line is Nuala O'Connor. Nuala, of course, your own book, Nora, was selected, your own novel was selected for One Dublin, One Book in 2022. Tell us about the feeling, which I presume you got at certain points in and around the city, when you saw people with copies of Nora, you know, pictures of it all over the place, people reading it in unusual places, and all at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of astonishing. I was, I've published a lot of books, and it's my book, you know, so it's kind of a beautiful and extraordinary feeling, and such loved put into One Dublin, One Book, such support from the libraries and from readers. So yeah, fabulous stuff.
And of course, it told the story of Nora Barnacle, and Dublin played such a central part in that story. It does go off to other parts of the world as well, but large sections of it. In fact, I remember the two of us walking around section parts of Dublin, kind of going to the locations where it was written. Your piece then, that Declan Mead, who has edited this new selection for us, Written in Our Hearts, where did that piece come from, Nuala?
So I went to school on Marlborough Street, which is parallel to O'Connell Street, and used to pass by the statue of Jesus in his little box. And I have a bit of a statue obsession anyway, but then he was getting a new box, and so this tweaked my interest. Now, this is back in 2010. This story is 15 years old or something. And he was getting a new box, and so I just became really interested in him. So there's two kind of lines of thinking about it. One says he was a gift from the Gresham Hotel, who were getting rid of him, to the taxi drivers. And another says that he was rescued from rubble during 1916. So I think the latter might be a little bit of fantasy. But he got a new box anyway, so my story sort of centres around that.
And putting yourself into the point of view of the statue, I was kind of surprised. There's a large amount. Well, I felt there was a large amount of empathy to the poor statue in this particular piece of yours.
Totally, like he'd been there a long time, and in my story, he's stretching his legs and moving about. That's the kind of conceit of the story, is that he's putting on a show with the arms up, you know.
Will you read us a little section?
I will, yeah. So I'll read from the second half. It's a two-page story. It's a flash fiction, really. The mother's down the Bull Island doing her Stella Maris thing, watching over the sailors. It's peaceful there, she tells me, gulls and boats and wind. But I like the bray of the city, the thrum and swagger of it. Give me sirens and buses and neon any day. I'm high on the hog here, all right. Parnell behind me, the spire before me, and Daniel O'Connell himself down the other end, standing proud. Ah, I've a great life, really. There's not a bother on me apart from the stiff shoulders and legs. Arthritis, the mother says. I knew that it happened the minute they cut down those trees. You're too exposed. Would you stop, I say, not wanting her going on. I'm grand. She puts on the face then. You know the face they make, all holier than thou and don't mind me. She doesn't mean to be getting at me, but she just worries. Anyway, it wouldn't do if I was caught slumped in the corner, dossing like some lackadaisy idler. No. Up I get, red robe straight, golden heart aglimmer and arms cruciform. I have work to do, a city of people to watch over, because I'm the Jesus of taxi man and traveller, of Garda and gambler, Jesus of the pissed and the pioneer. I'm Jesus of Culchi and Jackeen, Brasser and Nun, Jesus of Nigerian and Pole, of Wino and Weirdo, Jesus of soft rain, December snow and rare sun. I'm the Jesus of O'Connell Street, Jesus of Dublin.
That's Neil O'Connor reading from the closing section there of her. It is a flash fiction piece, almost like a performance poem. I could see you watching, particularly that last paragraph as Neil was reading it there, Stephen.
Yeah,
I'll come to you. But so, Neil, from Written in Our Hearts, the new this year's One Dublin One book selection, edited by Declan Mead, and you were that last section really does feel like almost like your own piece in the collection, Stephen. It has that refrain. Kind of litany aspect to it.
I was reading it earlier today in Tala Library, as it happens, and that last part particularly stood out for me, and I made a note of it because I'm working on it. You might have inspired me to end a new piece I'm working on.
Oh, there'll be Jesus in Dublin too.
Who knows, yeah. But and it's interesting as well, like the idea of him getting a new box, but before the part that Nuala read, he's still like, there's a confessional element to that box anyway, because people are still conversing with him and spitting on him and all sorts. It's a brilliant piece, really loved it.
And I mentioned your piece in the anthology is Dublin You Are. Mm-hmm. Is it safe to say, Stephen, that Dublin You Are changed your writing life?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about the genesis of it, and I'm sure it has changed and grown as you've performed it over the years, has it?
Well, the words haven't, but I guess my relationship with it has, and maybe the energy that I can put into it since I've left Dublin as well. My relationship with Dublin has changed also.
Yeah, because you now live in Wexford, isn't it?
But I wrote it 10 years ago, and actually the piece that I kind of alluded to there, I'm working on a sort of a 10-year anniversary piece for it at the moment, and I'm going to try and give that an airing tomorrow at an event I'm doing in Wexford, so I'll see how that goes. But it was weird, like a lot of opportunities came my way because of it, which I never would have expected. People in the past that I was emailing, you know, and not getting responses to, all of a sudden were emailing me, which was sort of a nice change in dynamic.
Just to remind people, you can read any section you want from it, because it's so recognisable. And when I hear you reading it, funny enough, today when I was reading it on the page, I thought, this is so different when I read it in my head from when I hear you reading it. You really bring something to it.
Well, I've probably said it so many bloody times now. It's in me. It's weird how physically I'll even change. But I'm sitting down now, but I won't be. But sure, will I give it a blast to start?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Sure, I'll just go from the top. Dublin, you are grey brick upon brick, full of tarmac and hipster pricks. Just face it. All other places pale in comparison. You are more than some former Saxon garrison, Dublin. Your warmth came too late for John Curry, Dublin. Are you even sorry, Dublin? You're divided by more than the Liffey. You said yes to equality. It's about bloom and time. Yet Dublin, you always proclaimed to cherish all Dublin. Your panties are on Capel Street, compromising any papal feats. Dublin, Jedward, awkward. Dublin, You're more than a settlement on the paddle, but Dublin, what's the crack with Codlet shite? Why don't you just admit it, Dublin? You brought back Sam again. When did you go from the Clash of the Ashes to exchanging gold for cash, Dublin? Dublin, Oblina, Balia Ahaclia, and 180 other tongues your citizens are using to name you, so Cade Mila Falcha to all. Might just leave it there, but yeah.
Cade Mila Falcha to all. That's Stephen James Smith's reading from Dublin You Are. His contribution to Dublin Written in Our Hearts, edited by Declan Mead, an anthology celebrating 20 years of Dublin City Council's One Dublin One Book. Are you as hard down on the coddle, Nuala, as Stephen is? He doesn't like it, clearly. Yeah, he doesn't like it. You like the coddle, do you?
Oh, absolutely loved it. Here's a fun fact. You mentioned Jedward in the poem. There, Ma was my English teacher.
Jesus. That's one line I slightly regret, because Jedward are legends.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm slightly poking fun at them, but I retrospectively, I don't know if I'd have written that, but it often gets a laugh, but actually I have a lot of respect for them.
And ironically, awkward makes sense in terms of, because it's Jedward awkward.
Yeah.
It makes sense in terms of what you're saying. It feels awkward saying it now, I'm sure.
It does, yeah. But that's the funny thing about writing something and 10 years on, how there's loads of things you change as you develop and as people develop. But actually, I do like Coddle, particularly from the Gravediggers there, because I'm sure the lads in there have served it to me. But it's a line sometimes you just throw to kind of get to be provocative, and it often gets a response.
One of the lines that struck me, Dublin, don't be scared to change, which is quite far into the poem. You're talking about the poem changes every time you perform it. Mm. Has Dublin changed for you from the city that you grew up in and started writing into now the city that you look back to in some ways living in Wexford?
Of course it has. That's really clear, Sean, for better and for worse. And unfortunately, I probably feel more so for worse. Mm. I'm very lucky that Wexford has embraced me and I love the people down there. But I mean, I probably would have chosen to stay in Dublin. In reality, I'd like to still live here. And walking around the past couple of days, been up, I've certainly missed it. So I do.
It's you're priced out of the market, as so many people are.
I've a good life. Okay? Yeah. I'm very lucky, but that's the reality of it.
Nuala, there are so many brilliant pieces in this, all of them published previously, as far as I'm aware. One that stood out for you, perhaps?
Paula Meehan's In Solidarity. Mm. And I do remember, I remember reading it in the book and knowing I had heard it before. Mm. I'd heard it actually on Sunday Miscellany, but whatever, coming back to it is astonishing. I mean, she's just one of those poets. She takes something ordinary and makes it extraordinary, dresses it in astonishing language. This is a narrative poem, an elegy, a lament. It's a eulogy, really, for Tony Gregory, who was a great inner city TD who advocated for the poor and the working classes, particularly in the north inner city, which is an area of Dublin I love, having gone to school there. He tackled drug problems, all of that. Can I read you a couple of verses from this?
I tell you, I don't have time to read any from this other collection, but I just wanted to get a sense of the poem from you, Nuala. And similarly, maybe, Stephen, you could tell us a piece that stood out for you, and we won't have time, unfortunately, to read from it.
Oh, so the piece that I particularly enjoyed was Ray Ukponu's piece Famine Days. It's about a young Nigerian teenager navigating family, faith and fractured identity in Dublin. It's a remarkable piece. I was crying in Tala Library today reading it, and I'm crying again rereading it out in the car before I came in here.
Well, listen, as I say, I'm sorry that we can't get to either of those two extra pieces, but there's a reason for people to go out and get a look at the book and read those two pieces in particular. And indeed, Nuala O'Connor's and Stephen James's as well, and lots of the other entries within it. Thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. Nuala joining us on the line, and Stephen James here in studio. Dublin, Written in Our Hearts, specially commissioned and chosen as the One Dublin One book for 2025. During April, writers and poets featured in the anthology will meet and discuss, read, perform and interact with book clubs appearing in various venues across the city, as well as Dublin City Libraries, DLR Libraries, Fingal Libraries and South Dublin Libraries. Full details on onedublinonebook.ie. The St. John Passion will be performed on Good Friday, April the 18th at the National Concert Hall, and it's something of an Easter tradition. But this year, rather than going to the work of classical composers like Johann Sebastian Bach, it will be the work of the world-renowned contemporary Scottish composer James McMillan. The Irish premiere of Macmillan's St. John Passion will be performed by the combined forces of the National Symphony Orchestra, Chamber Choir Ireland, the National Symphony Chorus, and soloist Sean Boylan, who will sing the part of Christ. I am delighted to be joined in studio by David Young, the choral director of the National Symphony Choir, and David Hill, joining us from England, the man who will be at the helm in the National Concert Hall on Good Friday evening for this mammoth piece. And clearly, David, you have to be called David Young, I better say, in studio with me. You have to be called David to be involved in the conducting side of this. But there are actually three conductors involved because the forces that are used are quite enormous. Before we get into all of that, when we talk about a passion or the passion in musical terms, what are we talking about?
So we're talking about the story of Jesus Christ's crucifixion, essentially. And in musical terms, it's a tradition which kind of grew out of the reading of those stories in church services or in a kind of, you know, a religious context into a more and more florid musical tradition that kind of developed over the centuries. And it kind of reached this sort of summation point with the Bach passions that we're all familiar with that we usually perform. And then it's sort of disappeared a little bit from musical history during the 19th century. There wasn't so much of it in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, we've seen a bit of a resurgence. And this piece brings us bang up to date in 2008. This was first performed. Yeah. And it's a sort of a telling of the story with a kind of narration of what's going on, the reading of the text from the story. And then as the music became more complicated through the centuries, you also saw more kind of reflective material go in there with different texts as well.
Yeah, and I suppose, David Hill, there are so many aspects to it, but I think David Young has hit on two very important things there. First of all, it was this participatory thing. I mean, many people may remember growing up where the Passion on Good Friday was spoken in church and the congregation took part in it. But here we have choruses singing, an orchestra playing, we have high drama, and we have these reflective moments, a real mix of emotions that we get within there. What is it about Macmillan's contemporary Passion that is so different?
Well, I think it's really right down to his own personal belief, his own faith. He's a very believing man. You know, he's a strong Catholic. He actually, I think, he almost writes this music in Account of the Story as a reaction to it himself, to the whole idea that it was happening. And therefore, it leads me to think that it's almost on the edge of being a sacred opera, where you have all these elements coming together. I mean, you wouldn't be able to stage this very, very easily, I suspect. But you can certainly imagine the drama of it in terms of just listening to it, what he's trying to depict, and it's quite visceral actually, but it's amazingly sort of compelling and challenging, but so compelling. So I think it's just a whole series of things. Now, David, other David, if you if in doubt, say David on this program, was alluding to the past accounts of writing for the Passion, and of course in the St. John Passion of Bach, which or the Matthew Passion, those were written in order to be part of a liturgy, actually. Yeah. But this was called, you know, Good Friday, and it was time for everyone to stand up and sing their Lutheran chorales in German, and then have a great big sermon in the middle of between the part one or whatever and part two.
Yeah.
So that's where Bach came from, where this is actually through composed with him depicting the story bit by bit in a very, as I say, very, very...
It's a visceral, visceral way.
Visceral, but I was going to word occasionally brutal, actually.
Yes,
But I would say is with such love and passion, his own personal passion for what is actually he's writing
the
about.
The story that he's telling. And one of the ways in which he does that, David Young, here in studio, normally in the Bach Passions, you have the evangelist who represents the writer of the Gospels. In this case, that role is taken over effectively by Chamber Choir Ireland, called the Narrator Chorus. So they're kind of giving us the cold, hard facts of then this happened, then that happened, then something else happened.
Exactly, yeah.
Pontius Pilate said this, Jesus said that. So they're quite clinical and cold in some ways in what
it's,
they're doing.
It's very declamatory. They tell the story in a way which is quite sort of straightforward.
Matter of fact,
and, yeah, it's matter of fact a lot of the time. And the music for that is also very matter of fact. You know, the writing for the small chorus is almost all in homophonic. So they're all singing the same thing at the same time, same text at the same time. And that contrasts pretty sharply with what we get for the big chorus. Chorus,
which is the National Symphony Chorus, which you have been with whom you have been working, and I would say I have had quite a task with the 120 singers or thereabouts. So big forces that had to be dealt with. I want to listen to one of the a little bit from the opening section, the very first scene, which is called The Arrest of Jesus. So we'll hear the narrator chorus. And we will hear at the end of this, we will also hear the large chorus. And in the middle, there's a little just treat that I want to let the listener hear, first of all, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. Section there from the opening, The Arrest of Jesus, of the St. John Passion of James McMillan, contemporary version of the Passion, which will be performed at the National Concert Hall on Good Friday afternoon with the National Symphony Orchestra, the National Symphony Chorus, and Chamber Choir Ireland, David Young, conductor, and I suppose the teacher in some ways of the National Symphony Chorus, with me here in studio and with us on the line, David Hill, who will be conducting the entire affair on the podium of the National Concert Hall. I wanted to hold off on the section in the middle of that where we heard the narrator chorus, you know, quite plainly saying, look, here's what happened. He was going to be arrested and he was standing there. And then he said, whom do you seek? And it's just a single voice. That's the only solo voice really that we get in the entire piece. Now, we hear Jesus several times.
Yeah.
But at other times, choruses play the part of Pontius Pilate. It's not just a single voice. That's a very definite choice on the part of Macmillan.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a stark contrast with what we hear in the Bach Passions, where in the Bach Passions, we're using those as the touchstone for this all the time, but that's for good reason. They're the most commonly performed. In those pieces, the evangelist tells a story, that's a soloist. We have Jesus who is a soloist. We have Pilate who is a soloist. Whenever anybody says something, there's a servant or a maid or something, that's a soloist. And in this piece, all of that stuff is done by the chorus, the big chorus. And equally in the Bach, we have these reflective arias that are sung by soloists as well. And in this piece, all of that material, there is reflective material, but it's sung by the big chorus.
Yeah, so it's always a chorus that's doing that work.
And there's something really unique about that when the bass section of the choir is singing the role of Pilate. There's something kind of, it gives this sort of collective voice to it, that it is a single person speaking with a single voice, but it's been put through this sphere where we hear everybody saying it. And it puts the whole piece into this kind of realm where Jesus is on his own and everything else comes from the collective.
I think it also has that thing, as a listener, you kind of feel complicit in the
absolutely
words of the chorus.
It draws you in when the big chorus is singing, you feel as if you're part of what they're saying.
And as we heard there in that section from the opening, then when the large chorus comes in, they really do have a lot of serious work to do. I suppose we could argue, David Hill, that there is another character very much so in this piece, which is the orchestra.
I think it's a really very good point. I think, you know, you've just covered, I think, the whole sort of gamut, if you like, of what's actually happening. But within all of that, the orchestra is, if you like, the foundations on which everything else have to be, as it were, built. And their writing, actually, is incredibly complex. And it's not surprising, because it was originally a commission from the London Symphony Orchestra, who you know will tackle anything. But it's, you know, it, and so will the National Symphony Orchestra, I know. But I'm trying to say is it's not for the faint-hearted. This, it's really incredibly challenging to all of the players. So there are sort of many dimensions to the work. It needs. Dare I say, from my point of view, it's multidimensional, of course. You know, when you conduct a Bach Passion, and as David said, you know, quite rightly, you know, you've got a lot of people doing lots of different things, and you kind of just pull it together in the best way you can. And of course, you're there to be keeping it all in shape. But this actually requires constantly working with the orchestra separately, then the Chamber Choir Ireland, and then the symphony chorus, and then of course the, you know, lots, and particularly actually I could say he loves writing for brass, particularly, and he wants the brass to really feature, and they will really need lots of encouragement to know when to step out and when not to.
I had chosen a piece that I wanted to listen to for that very reason, which is the opening of part two, the Crucifixion, and certainly the opening section here will put lots of the brass players will have to make sure that the lips are in good order.
Yep.
Yes, the brass players certainly being put to their task there in the Crucifixion, the opening of part two of James McMillan's St. John Passion, which will be performed at the National Concert Hall Good Friday afternoon. The recording we just heard, incidentally, is the London Symphony Chorus. There's the London Symphony Orchestra there. We heard the London Symphony Chorus earlier on, and Sir Colin Davis was conducted, for whom this piece was written, I think, as an 80th birthday present. But David Hill. The balance between, I guess, on the night, you're in total command of what happens on stage, or you have to be in total command. It can't be you and David sitting across the studio from me saying, "Will you do this little bit and I'll do that little bit?" And Paul Hillier of Chamber Choir, and he can do that little bit. You have to just keep the three sets of forces, and soloist John Boylan, you have to keep them in the same space together.
Yes, and I think it's a challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge. And I would say, I mean, David Young will have been conducting a lot of it with, and knowing, you know, the what it is to have to deal with the links between some of these sections, which are really very fast indeed. And it doesn't hang around, as James. He when he wants to go to a particular point and make a point, he gets there. But you're constantly changing speed. That's the thing. And therefore, it's actually having a knowledge of exactly where you want to be with your tempo, so that everyone can be feeding from that and hopefully going in the same direction.
I was actually going to say something about this, David, that it's really interesting and marked how different the idioms are for all the different groups, isn't it? I was thinking as we were listening to that excerpt from the first part, that the contrast between how the music sounds for Chamber Choir Ireland, which is that very kind of ancient feeling chant-like music, and then the very complex writing for Jesus, which has got a very characterful and big leaps in the melody and that kind of thing, and then this sort of epic sweep for the big chorus, you have to shift gears so quickly when you're conducting it because you have such big contrast between the idioms for all the different groups.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think, as I feel it at the moment, the sort of the way which you will be, I will be conducting Sean Boylan for Christus, will be, generally speaking, quite a legato, connected kind of feel, because you get this sort of almost a sheen of sound around Jesus that he gives it that particular character. But then, you know, the sharp-edged, you know, fast-moving, rhythmic stuff, which the chorus will be singing, as you know, requires something completely different. You know, it's as if you suddenly have to go right into really rhythmic clicks so that everyone knows exactly where they are. So, yeah, it's a whole series of moods, really, which, as a conductor, you've got to try and work on.
Well, it certainly will be a very dramatic afternoon. Everybody, we would say to the singers, chocolate will have to be avoided for several reasons, obviously, up until that point in time, but certainly for the vocal cords, they will have earned their Easter eggs come Easter Sunday morning.
They certainly will.
I want to finish with a section which shows us a kind of a... the invention of James McMillan, I think, in some ways, David Young. This is from Jesus and His Mother. And he brings in, to my mind, he brings in pieces from elsewhere here. Maybe you'd explain. Yeah. I think we're going to hear a little bit that uses that Christmas carol, Luli Lule.
Yeah,
or something in the nature of that.
One of the things which is so distinctive about James McMillan's style is that he has these different contrasting ideas which make up a lot of the stuff that he does. David's talked quite a bit about the sort of rhythmic, almost brutal, barbaric music, which has always been present in everything that he's written. There's always that kind of violence under the surface. But he also writes very, very lyrically and in very traditional ways as well, with very kind of beautiful harmonies. And this passage uses kind of Scots folk song, Celtic folk song quite extensively. And you can really hear that character coming through here. And that is present in all of his music, in all of his melodic writing. You can hear that kind of folk tradition.
Absolutely. Can I just say before you go there that it doesn't end, dare I say, with words or the choir.
Yes.
It ends with the orchestra. And he ends it in the most extraordinarily passionate way with a quiet... almost as if he's, dare I say, as if someone is crying in the corner about what's happened, lament. And then within the lament appears this extraordinarily Celtic melody played in the brass. And it is just absolutely spine-tingling.
Yeah, I must say that closing section, the purely orchestral closing section, really caught me by surprise when I listened.
It's absolutely stunning, isn't it?
Extraordinary moment.
I thought I'd mention it because it's so unexpected.
Yeah.
And it's not how any previous work of this sort of nature has ever ended before.
Yeah, well, those who want to hear that will have to go along on Good Friday afternoon to hear it. Because
I'm
not
going to... tune in as well. We're on Lyric.
Oh, yeah,
as well.
You're on Lyric and live. Yeah. It'll be going out live.
I think it might be in the evening
right,
on Lyric.
We'll double-check that for you. Let us finish then with that section of Jesus and his Mother from part two, isn't it? Yes, from part two of the James McMillan Passion. David Young, David Hill, thank you so much for speaking with us this evening on Arena.
Thank you, Sean.
A pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Sean.
Jesus and His Mother from part two of the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus recording of James McMillan's St. John Passion. David Young and David Hill speaking to me about that. They will be conducting the National Symphony Orchestra in the case of David Hill and the National Symphony Chorus in the case of David Young. Hope I've got those two Davids right. And also present on the night, of course, will be Chamber Choir Ireland performing McMillan's St. John's Passion. Good Friday, April 18th, Irish premiere on the main stage of the National Concert Hall. It's to 3:30 p.m. nch.ie will give you all of the details there, and the performance will be recorded and broadcast on RTE Lyric FM at 7:30 that evening. That's Good Friday, April the 18th. That's our lot for this Wednesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Crean will be with you after the news.